mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, after last night's city council meeting, Findlay Mayor Christina Mern shares her reaction to the proposed framework on data center zoning and new questions about the city's flood mitigation plan, including what to do with any leftover funds after the current projects are completed. Also this morning, August is Wellness Month. With lots of questionable advice coming from all directions, we have physician-approved tips you can trust to help look and feel your best. And happening around town, let's take a stroll around downtown Findlay with this week's Summer Art Walk. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, August 5th, 2026. I know how it is. Sometimes you wake up, you dread going to work, right? I mean, we're halfway through the week or that midpoint of the week, and we've got just as much time left in the week as we've knocked out already. And oh, I got to go to work. I would love to just hang out a shingle and set my own rules, set my own hours, you know? If you've ever thought of starting your own business, venturing out on your own, you are in the right place. Results of a new survey from the job search platform Monster show a number of Ohio cities are among the best in the country when it comes to places to start a career. Monster looked at 100 of the country's largest metropolitan areas and considered available data in the categories of job availability and housing costs. So I guess this is more of, I guess I set this up improperly. It's not an idea of, you know, going out and striking out on your own. This is more like switching careers. And maybe you have thought about that. You know, you wake up in the morning and you have this recurring thing. I don't want to go to work. I'm not motivated by a job. I want to do something new, something different. This is just not for me. Well, that's kind of the setup for this. Ohio placed 5 cities in the top 10. 5. Akron at number 2, Dayton at number 3, Cleveland at number 5, Toledo at number 6, and Columbus at number 7. Half of the top 10 are Ohio cities. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, incidentally, topped the list. And then the other cities in the top 10 were Madison, Wisconsin, Pittsburgh, Kansas City, and Milwaukee. So interesting that they were all kind of here in the Midwestern region of the country, but Ohio, the only state with multiple cities in the top 10, and not just that, half of the top 10. So pretty good place to start a career or restart a new career, as it happens. So anyway, so that was kind of interesting. Here's another interesting list to start with this morning. According to an analysis of 2 decades worth of data on power outages, including how frequently they happen, how long they last, and the cause, between 2003 and 2023, California led the nation with 493 significant power outages. Texas came in second, followed by Washington State and Michigan. Ohio, on this list, ranked 9th in the U.S. in the number of power outages, significant power outages. Now, little power outages and blips and all of they happen quite frequently, but we're talking about significant power outages. Ohio had 135 significant power outages. And again, this is between 2003 and 2023. So 20 years of data. 135 significant outages in that time, affecting 18.6 million people and averaging nearly 36 hours each. Wow. Particularly noteworthy is the fact that in Ohio, August is the top month for blackouts. So we are into the top month right now. July is second for most frequent power outages, and then February is the third most common month. And that is not the same in every state, but that's Ohio. I found that to be rather interesting and thought I would share. Morning. A couple of other items here, some other stuff. Among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Back to school time, as we know. Findlay City Schools back in class in just about a week, right? My goodness. And a lot of the other schools around the area wait until after the fair, after Labor Day. But it is most assuredly back to school season. A new survey from ABC News and Ipsos finds that the majority of parents with children in kindergarten through 12th grade said that they expect to spend, are you ready for this, nearly $900 per child this year on items to get them ready to go back to the classroom. $900 per kid. Just for comparison, think about this. How much did you spend per kid on Christmas last year? I think a lot of people probably spent less than that on the holiday season per kid. And this is just to get them back to school. And breaking that down, it's an average of $337 on items for after-school activities. Sports, extracurriculars, whatever it might happen to be. That's actually the largest chunk of money going to after-school activities. So it's not so much school itself, it's everything else. $275 on clothing and shoes. So we know how expensive that is. $118 on school supplies on average. That would include backpacks and lunchboxes. $102 on technology, calculators, tablets, laptops. I don't know how you can find a tablet or a laptop for $102, but that's the average on technology, $102. And $52 on books. Parents of high schoolers and middle schoolers say they expect to spend far more on clothing and shoes on average than elementary school parents. So I can kind of skew the numbers a little bit there. But I would imagine also for high school and middle school parents, parents of high schoolers and middle schoolers probably spending more on those, you know, after school activities, sports and so on than elementary school students as well. So, but that is just amazing. $900. And that's how it kind of breaks down. See if that holds true in your case. This is big news from the health and medical file this morning. Apparently, and this happens so often, we hear about all of the good things about a new diet trend, or we need to eat more of that, or drink less of this, or you know whatever it might happen to be. But then, invariably, later we hear conflicting information. You know, eggs are terrible for us because of all of the cholesterol. And then later on, oh, well, maybe they're not so bad. Don't drink too much coffee. It's bad for you. And then later, oh, well, there's some good things to go along. You know what I mean, right? So here is the latest. A new scientific review challenges the growing protein craze, suggesting that eating less protein, not more, may support better aging. So this has been a trend of late, is this protein craze, this protein diet, this protein thing. Researchers found that protein restriction consistently extended lifespan and improved metabolic health. And this was, they didn't test this on humans. They tested it on, you know, animals and so on. But in their experiments, protein restriction was better for you in the long run. Short-term human trials did show real improvements in blood sugar, insulin sensitivity, and body fat. Okay. Notably, just three amino acids, methionine, isoleucine, and valine. I don't know. These amino acids appear to drive the most benefits, meaning total protein cuts may not be necessary. However, researchers caution that the restriction is not safe for everyone, including pregnant women, children, and elderly individuals who are already protein deficient. Long and short of it is the growing protein craze may not be all it's cracked up to be. Eating less protein, not more, may support better aging. So there you go. You can make of that what you will, but that's the latest conflicting. There's always conflicting information. I guess it can be expected. You take the good with the bad. Whenever you increase your intake of any food or drink or, you know, whatever, there's always a trade-off, right? So whether you're increasing or decreasing this, that, or the other thing, there's always a trade-off, and now you know. So make up your own mind, I guess. And by the way, speaking of protein, USA Today is out with their annual list of the best fast food burgers. Now, this is more my speed. This is up my alley here. Best fast food burgers. Forget about all of that health stuff. This is what I really want to know about. USA Today out with their annual list of the best fast food burgers. The top spot, once again, has been claimed by Habit Burger & Grill's Double Char. The Habit Burger & Grill chain is based in Santa Barbara. They have some 350 locations, but only out west and on the East Coast. That's where there's none around here. So if you want to go and get the best burger, you got to take a road trip. But maybe the next time you're on vacation, you might see a Habit Burger & Grill. Go ahead and stop, because it's a pretty good burger, according to USA Today. In-N-Out's Double-Double came in second. Again, something that you don't find around here. But if you have ever been to, especially out west, where they have In-N-Outs on every corner, you probably had a Double-Double. So you can agree or disagree, but that was number two on the list. But it's another delicacy you can't get around here. Freddy's Original Double from Freddy's Frozen Custard and Steak Burgers came in third, and you can savor that burger at locations in Columbus, Dayton, and Cincinnati. So they do have those in Ohio. Bit of a drive, but the next time you're in Columbus, or Dayton or Cincinnati, check out a Freddy's Original Double, Freddy's Frozen Custard and Steak Burgers. After that, then you get to some that are more widely available, the A&W Papa Burger and the Culver's Butter Burger round out the top five. So we certainly have, you know, at least Culver's. A&W, I think we've got some of those around this general area, but you know, Culver's Butter Burger, pretty easy to get. That's a pretty good one. Followed by signature burgers from Shake Shack, and Five Guys. And then actually Burger King's Whopper came in eighth as the best fast food burger. Eighth best fast food burger. Burger King's Whopper. Wow. Wendy's Son of Baconator was ninth. And the classic Whataburger rounded out the top 10. And Whataburger, again, one of those things we don't have around here, but if you are, you know, traveling sometime, you can't go wrong with a good Whataburger. So there you go. Now you know, this is love lists, and this is a pretty important one there. The best fast food burgers in America. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories there to get your Wednesday morning started.
The news and issues of the day. The Brian Kilmeade Show. Weekday mornings at 9 on 1330 WFIN and 95.5 FM.
Now, our cover story this morning. There were a couple of key moments at last night's Findlay City Council meeting. First, as expected, the proposed framework for zoning rules on data centers was presented to the full council by the Planning and Zoning Committee. And then later on, during the public comment period of the meeting, 6th Ward resident James Routson stepped up and challenged the city's flood mitigation plan and raised questions about what should be done with any leftover funds that may remain after the current projects are completed. Right after the meeting concluded yesterday evening, we spoke with Mayor Christina Mern. There are still several steps that have to be taken before any updated zoning regulations on data centers will be ready to put into place. But based on what has been presented and the work that has been done so far by the Planning and Zoning Committee, What are your thoughts? What's your immediate reaction with what you have seen so far?
Yeah, I would think that we really approached it from a comprehensive standpoint that gives us both flexibility in that this technology is evolving so quickly. We don't want to put like two defined parameters, which then we're constantly updating it. So what we've really tried to do is put a lot of different restrictions with as much flexibility for us to review and make decisions on a case-by-case basis. So I think, honestly, it's really comprehensive. We've really, I had kind of initially introduced a lot of this from what I've heard from other communities that have been working on this for a couple of years. So I think we're way ahead of the conversation in like how it should be crafted in a lessons learned type of way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's still a lot of dialogue to have with the community so that they are understanding and comfortable with it. And then, you know, getting better understanding of maybe tweaks that we need to make. We're not in a rush. But I think, you know, my goal would to be have this done before budget season really kicks off, because we just get so busy with lots of other things.
Mm-hmm.
That being able to have this put in place, you know, it has to go all three readings. Zoning items cannot be expedited. So it needs to have all three readings. Then it has to sit for 30 days before it becomes effective. So we don't necessarily have as much time as, you know, like, hey, we can just wait and not address this until
right.
October. I think we really need to take a look at it and get it in place sooner than later.
Now,
so that we know that we're protected as a community.
And as has been said numerous times, the idea is to put some guardrails on data center development. But would these rules strictly apply to data centers, or I mean, can you narrow it down to specifically target that, or is there the possibility that other projects could end up getting caught in additional regulation and zoning requirements that could hinder other types of development?
I don't think that I see anything else really getting caught up in these regulations. First of all, a parcel would have to specifically request the I-3 zoning designation to start with before any of the parameters of the conditional use review would kick into place. And given that there are no parcels zoned as I-3 currently, a business that's wanting to develop is most likely going to fall under the I-1 or I-2.
The other topic that was brought up at this week's city council meeting, and it was reported just within the past few days, this came out. James Routson addressed council on the topic of flood mitigation, specifically concerns regarding the Sixth Ward and the impact, or in his words, lack thereof, of flood mitigation impact on areas west of the railroad bridge. His implication is that very little, if anything, has been done to mitigate flood risk west of the railroad bridge, the part of town that would include Maple Grove Cemetery and that area. I think we've all kind of been operating on the presumption that while the benefits of any one part of this project would not necessarily benefit the entire city, that all of the parts taken together would benefit the entire city. Is that not the case?
No, that is the case. This flood mitigation effort has been, you know, very multifaceted. And I understand Mr. Routson's concerns. However, I think that they're invalid. He's talking specifically about phase two benching in Eagle Creek Basin.
Mm-hmm.
What he failed to really talk about was the phase one benching, which provides the most significant benefit to his area. Initially, you know, we're already seeing the benefits in the Sixth Ward and west of downtown. And then the phase two benching, the Norfolk Southern Railroad Bridge and the basin are all going to provide additional benefit. His primary concern was the belief that with the railroad bridge now being elevated, that water is going to move through too quickly and actually negatively impact their properties.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just is not, you know, the case. We have, you know, had a lot of engineers that have spent the last 20 years looking at this, evaluating it. And I think the other misconception is that we're going to have a bunch of leftover money from the grants as it stands, and we really don't anticipate that either. So some of the initial numbers that were shared by the newspaper were just misconstrued a bit. And so we are not anticipating, we may have a little bit of money, but the reality is that with change orders, et cetera, we anticipate using all of those funds. And if anything is left, we have asked what is the flexibility? We have already asked that question. Unfortunately, with federal dollars, it is very challenging because it literally is like a congressional authorized spend for a specific purpose. So I understand his concerns. We have actually been speaking with Mr. Routson for many months, and I just think that you know, we are addressing it the appropriate way. I appreciate his concerns, but I think that they're being overstated.
And with respect to those leftover funds, you say there might be a little bit. What would define a little bit?
Yeah, well, compared to, you know, the $100 million in flood mitigation efforts that we've invested over the past couple of decades, I would be surprised if we have $1 million left.
And you believe, would we have to send that back then? Or I guess, as you mentioned, that's still being sorted out. But is that, are we operating under that assumption that it would have to go back?
Yes. Yes, there is very strict parameters on what we're allowed to use it for. We have asked and are working with EMA if there's any additional things. But again, it is very strict. So there is portions of the basin that are options. So, you know, we'll have more clarity as we move forward. Mm-hmm. We're not, you know, not asking the question, but so far our response from the federal government has been, it cannot be used outside of the project areas that had already been identified, gone through environmental review, gone through the cost benefit analysis, have gone through the hydraulic engineering. We've done all the federal permits. Like, this has not been a overnight, hey, we can just add this on real quick situation. It's very well thought out, where we've been working on this for a long time. So again, I think that his assessment of us not doing enough to benefit the Western area is inaccurate, especially with the phase one benching being completed in first in preparation, in recognition of the impacts that the phase two benching and the bridge replacement were going to have in that area.
That being said, in the comments at the meeting, you did acknowledge that this is something that we'll continue to look at and monitor and so on. And that actually kind of brings up another question that really hasn't been asked, and maybe it's because we're not quite there yet. But once all of these current projects that are still in the works are done, the additional benching, the dry basin, and so on and so forth, is there a plan for continuing to monitor, you know, whether or not all of these projects have been as effective as they are anticipated to be, or if there needs to be any additional work done down the line if needed? I mean, is there a plan for what to do after we've wrapped all of this project?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing is, one, we'll see the map revision. So that's going to just be the on-paper modifications that will benefit property owners. But the data collection is going to be seeing, moving forward, that flood events, that level of, you know, moderate, minor, major flood events continue to decrease. And we watch the hydraulic, you know, curvature of the Blanchard River and Eagle Creek and Lime Creek during every storm event. And, you know, we don't have sufficient enough data to quantify the benefits just of the phase one at this point. But I would tell you, from our observations, it has 100% helped. You know, when we've been working with the National Weather Service and their predictions over the last few years, when they've been projecting much more significant river elevations, those have not occurred. And we really do believe that that's from the phase one. We can point back to a couple of you know, storm events where it was 2 feet lower than what they were projecting. And that, you know, we believe that's a direct result of the phase one. So we'll continue to monitor that. And if we see areas that we think that there's additional benefit, then we'll, you know, evaluate the benefit that those provide.
We will leave it there for now. Again, Findlay Mayor Christina Mern, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Of course. Appreciate it.
Well, August is National Wellness Month, but with wellness advice coming from all directions these days, it can sometimes be difficult to know what is actually backed by science and what is simply the latest fad, or even worse, something that could actually have the opposite effect. With that in mind, we are joined this morning by Dr. Yael Varnado, practicing physician at Johns Hopkins and regular TV contributor known as Dr. V. So clearly, you are media savvy. You understand how certain things kind of catch fire with the public. Talk a little bit about why National Wellness Month is important and why it's important to be able to distinguish between the facts and the hype that is often amplified online.
Well, Chris, you're 100% right. I mean, the landscape is different now than it was, 20, 30 years ago, where people went to their doctor and their doctor was kind of like, the be-all, end-all of information, right? And now you can get information everywhere.
Yeah.
Some places you may not even want it from. And you even mentioned AI now, too.
Yeah.
So it's important that we work collaboratively as patients, doctor, wellness provider, whoever it is that you trust that you go to get your information from, and be proactive. That's what National Wellness Month is about, being proactive. So finding ways to emphasize, making healthy decisions for every day. Things can be easy, like staying hydrated, eating a nutritious, balanced diet, getting good sleep. Things that we can do to build habits for the long term and for a lifetime.
Yeah, we talk about some of this hype that we constantly are bombarded with, as you were mentioning. I like to call it fact or Facebook, separating the fact from the online stuff that is out there. And it's interesting you mention that a lot of times it really boils down to simple stuff that we've heard time and time again. So where is a good place to start?
Well, it can feel very insurmountable to think about, how do I take a first step to improve my wellness? What do I do? And so an easy place to start is with personal hygiene. And studies have shown that we touch our noses over 100 times a day, Chris. That's an amazing number, isn't it? So keeping your nose clean is important, as is washing your hands. And so the nose and nasal sanitizer antiseptic, it's an easy addition to your daily wellness routine. It helps kill 99.99% of germs. You can think of it kind of like hand sanitizer, but for your nose. And it's used by more than 1,000 healthcare facilities across the U.S., and it's safely been used for more than 20 years. I love that it comes in a bottle for home use, or even the pop swab ampule for on the go. And you can find it at nosen.com or Amazon.
All right. What is next in terms of taking care of our bodies?
Something that's simple, that's easy. It doesn't have to be complicated. Olay's Super Routine makes it really easy to refresh your summer body care with its Super Serum Body Wash and Super Serum Body Lotion. And I love, because it's inspired by Olay's most awarded facial serum, that duo is bringing the brand's award-winning skincare technology to your shower and your post-shower routine. And it delivers 5 visible benefits. You have hydration, firming, smoothing, brightening, and evening skin tone. It's really a simple head-to-toe refresh for every skin type and everyone. And you can find it at all major retailers nationwide.
Okay, and you were mentioning earlier sleep, which I don't know how many times we've talked about this, but it bears repeating. That is one of the most overlooked, especially these days. It seems like none of us are getting enough sleep, but that is one of the most overlooked yet easy ways of, kind of recharging our bodies.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems easy to say, it seems easy to get, but a lot of people struggle with sleep for a host of reasons. But one of the first things that you can do is create a comfortable sleep environment that's going to make a real difference. And Breescape cooling sheets made with BlendTec cooling technology, it's engineered directly into the fabric. So it's going to regulate your temperature and manage moisture, so you get a breathable comfort throughout the night. This is really important for people who suffer from hot flashes, from menopausal symptoms, or just being really hot and at night. And if you pair their sheets with the Breescape cooling comforter, you have a complete cooling bedding solution. And that's designed to help you sleep more comfortably. comfortably. And you can search Breezescape cooling sheets on Amazon today.
And you have one more thing here for Wellness Month. What is that?
Absolutely. You know, we all know someone who's been successful on a GLP-1 and they've lost weight, but a lot of people are challenged when they think about how do I keep that weight off? And so I've been talking to my patients about Metabiotics Weight Manager. It's a new postbiotic designed to protect your progress. And, you know, most of the gut health products that are out on the market really rely on live bacteria, but Metabiotics uses a pasteurized postbiotic form of Acromantia mucinophila, Mucinophila mucti, and that's the clinically studied form that supports weight maintenance. Because honestly, keeping the weight off is the real win.
All right.
And everyone can use code AKM15 at shopmetabiotics.com for 15% off.
Awesome stuff there. So there you go. There's kind of the four legs of our stool here for National Wellness Month. Dr. Yael Varnado, a.k.a. Dr. V, with us this morning, talking about the wellness advice that you can trust, that you can count on to have you feeling your best for this National Wellness Month in August. Where do we get more information?
Well, Chris, for all the things that we talked about today, you can check out tipsontv.com.
Dr. V, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Be well.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
A man is facing charges after jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge while naked this past Sunday afternoon. just a way to kill a lazy Sunday. Authorities say the 44-year-old man could be seen climbing the north tower of the bridge, blocking traffic before then removing his robe and jumping fully naked into the East River below. Harbor unit of the NYPD pulled him to safety, and he was taken to the hospital for evaluation. Cops say he left behind a robe and a blanket covered with illegible scribbles from where he jumped, which gave them no clue as to exactly why he would do such a thing. He is facing a slew of charges, including criminal trespass, graffiti, and public lewdness. Oh, I'm bored today. What am I going to do? What am I going to do this weekend? I know. I'll jump off the Brooklyn Bridge naked. Wow. Elsewhere in the broken news, a Minnesota man is facing charges after allegedly installing a homemade spike strip on his lawn to stop the neighborhood kids from cutting through his yard. Hey, kids, get off my lawn. He actually put a spike strip on his lawn. Police were called after a neighbor reported hearing 39-year-old Kyle James Steffen yelling at her children. Officers discovered a thick plastic strip embedded with roughly 43-inch screws. Mr. Steffen admitted placing the device to keep the kids off his lawn after he claims that he had repeatedly warned them. He told officers he wanted to scare the kids, not necessarily injure anyone, but police noted that he seemed frustrated that the device was not effective. He said he didn't want to hurt anyone, but he was a little upset that it didn't work as advertised. He faces up to 180 days in jail on this, plus a $1,000 fine. And finally, in the broken news this morning, a woman in Lexington, Kentucky was growing impatient with the amount of time it was taking to get her order at a KFC drive-thru several weeks ago. And I think this is a frustration that we can all relate to, right? Having to wait an exorbitant amount of time in the drive-thru lane. So, 33-year-old Nada Roman did what any reasonable person would do in that situation. After exchanging some pointed words with the staff, she pulled into a parking space, opened her trunk, retrieved her semi-automatic rifle, and threatened an employee before fleeing. Can you say overreaction? a semi-automatic rifle at the workers. That'll speed them up. Police police used security footage at the drive-thru to identify her vehicle and then confirmed her identity through body camera footage from prior interactions with the police. So, not her first run-in with the law, apparently. She was positively identified in a photo lineup by the employee that she threatened. Ms. Roman now faces one count of first-degree wanton endangerment. The story, by the way, does not say whether or not she ever actually got her food. Again, it's a frustration we can all relate to. I think we've all been there, right? Maybe not taking it to that extreme. We can certainly relate to the issue. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Your home of the Ohio State Buckeyes is WFIN. Follow the Buckeyes through training camp with reports each weekday morning as the Buckeyes prepare for the upcoming season. We'll get you ready for another year of Buckeye football, which begins Saturday, September 5th. Catch the training camp updates presented by Hitchings Insurance weekday mornings at 11:15 during the midday report on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. This may be a bit of a sore spot for empty nesters. I think most parents whose kids have grown and left the house can relate to this. Nearly half of Americans in a new survey of 2,000 adults, nearly half of Americans, 46%, still store at least some of their belongings at their parents' house. How much of your old stuff do you still have at your parents' home? On average, adult kids have 9 boxes of stuff each. This is according to the survey. Again, 2,000 adults in this survey. They found Gen Z and millennials are most likely to be storing items at their parents' homes. 82% of Gen Zers and 69% of millennials still have their stuff at their parents' home. But even 46% of Gen Xers still do. I mean, Gen Xers are the ones that are now becoming empty nesters themselves. We're just leaving this trail of stuff. Our kids have stuff at our house. We have stuff at our parents' house. It's just we're leaving a trail of junk. Preservation and safekeeping. Preservation and safekeeping at top of the reasons at 41%. And I suppose there's maybe some comfort in that. We figured that our stuff is safer at our parents' house. Maybe that's it. But 41% say preservation and safekeeping. Even though they have had the least time to accumulate things, Gen Zers were the most likely out of all age groups to feel that their homes are overflowing with stuff, that their own homes are overflowing with stuff. Meaning that they don't have room to take back their stuff from their parents. 62% of Gen Zers felt that way. 59% of millennials say, I just don't have room at my own house for all of my stuff. Over a third of respondents also rent storage units for all of their stuff, keeping them an average of 8 years. And the reason we're hanging on to all of this, sentimentality. We're just sentimental about all of this old stuff we just can't get rid of. We just got to hang on to. 45% say it's just we're hanging on to it for sentimental reasons. And I would imagine that that's one of the things that keeps those rental storage places in business. I mean, heaven forbid we ever, you know, stop being sentimental about all this stuff that we're accumulating that we never use, we never even see. but we just know it's there, and there's some comfort in knowing it's there. Heaven forbid if we ever get over that, what would all of these self-storage places do? They'd probably all be out of business. Well, it is a big weekend. A lot of things going on around the community. We were talking about Balloon Fest and all of that. And let's not forget Art Walk is kind of kicking off the weekend on Friday, the Summer Art Walk event. And Sarah Foltz with the Findlay-Hancock County Alliance is with us this morning. Always a huge event for downtown Findlay and for all of the artists that get a chance to show off their works during this quarterly event.
Yes, yes, it is. And we just love being able to not only celebrate the arts, but also see just the energy throughout downtown Findlay. So you see a number of boutiques that stay open later. We have every nook and cranny of downtown filled with all different styles of artwork, and they're all local and regional artists that come out for this.
So I am looking down the list, and as always, there are quite literally dozens of locations that are hosting various artists. And when we say artists, that casts a pretty wide net.
Yes, yes. Now, while we really, really focus in on both visual and performing arts, you see everything from live music to artist displays where you can purchase the artwork. And that includes everything from sketches to acrylic, oil, graphite, colored pencil, handmade items and trinkets. It really is, you're going to find something for everyone.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about everything that is happening. Again, it is Friday is the day, and it begins like right after work. So just head downtown and hang out. But like we said, more than two dozen locations that are participating this time around.
Yeah, we kick off right at 5 o'clock. And honestly, it's perfect because even if you leave work a little bit early and enjoy happy hour, let's say, you can grab a Dora beverage and enjoy downtown. And throughout the entire map, we tend to get add-ons even toward the end. So I highly recommend folks check out visitfindlay.com because that online map is going to be the most up to date. Right now, we sit at 32 locations. Wow. Participating in Art Walk. And I do have to say, the goal is not to be able to visit every single place. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
But that's why we do Art Walk 4 times a year. So I always approach it personally. It's one of my favorite downtown events. And I pick a different corner of downtown to start in for each Art Walk. And then you can kind of follow the map and just stop by any place that you walk by.
And there's plenty to choose from because you go from like the Hancock Hotel all the way down to the Marathon Center and, you know, everything in between. A lot of places on, you know, some of the side streets, especially on Crawford and Sandusky in particular. You know, there's a lot of things that are going on at just about every storefront. So
that's exactly right. And when you start to, we do have a couple locations that don't always participate. That's very well worth the stop. For example, the Hancock Historical Museum will be open that evening. They're not typically open on Friday evening, so that will be well worth the stop. And then, of course, our anchor locations, which is the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts, the Jones Building, and the Findlay Art League.
Yeah. Again, the businesses I know really look forward to this and seeing the crowds and having you stop by and all of that. As you mentioned, Sarah, a lot of them are going to have extended hours and things like that. The artists really look forward to this every year as well, especially the Jones Building artists, a chance to get up and see all of those studios.
Yes, if you've never been upstairs inside the Jones Building, it does feel like you're walking into another world because it's not an area you can explore any given day. And these sure. artists take so much time and care in their studios so that they can open them up and welcome visitors.
So again, it is Friday. It begins at 5, runs until about 9. A lot of things that are going on. And you know, I'd love to be able to talk about all of these things because, like we said, there are... You know, what'd you say, 30 some odd that are participating?
Yes.
You
know, yes. 32 locations, and some locations have multiple artists. Yeah. So well over 30 artists, too. Can't
possibly mention all of them. But like you said, you've got a you've got the list online, and also, you know, all of the artists at each location. So you can kind of plan out your plan of attack, if you will.
Absolutely. That is a great idea. And also, if you're just exploring, we will have Art Walk flags hanging outside of every participating business too. So if you just want to, you know, go in blind and just explore, there will be a nice little sign that'll tell you where you can just jump right in.
All right. Again, Sarah Foltz with the Findlay-Hancock County Alliance with us this morning, previewing Art Walk on Friday evening, downtown Findlay. And Sarah, thanks very much for taking the time. Here's to another great event downtown. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. That is goodmornings.net. You can also connect with us on social media, sign up for our daily email newsletter, and more. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would also appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform. That will help others discover the show as well. And we thank you very much for your help with that. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.